Okay, so in this talk I want to try and review what we know about localization transitions in the context of both the quantum Hall effect in two dimensions and also the more recent topic of the quantum Hall effect in three-dimensional systems. So most of what I have to say about two-dimensional systems is far from new, but I hope it'll be useful to have a summary as a starting point for discussions. What I have to say about three-dimensional systems is somewhat newer, and hopefully it'll be an introduction to the theoretical ideas that are relevant to the experimental session that comes later on this afternoon. So in the context of the regular two-dimensional integer quantum Hall effect, the central question is to what extent do the plateau transitions look like quantum critical points? And you can ask this question in the context of real experiments, or if the experiments don't always do what you'd like, you can go to computer simulations. When I get on to talk about the quantum Hall effect in three-dimensional systems, I want to talk about the phase diagram and then particularly about chiral surface states in bulk quantum Hall plateaus. And if I have time, I'll say a little bit about experiments as an introduction to the later talks. So most of what we think we understand about localization transitions in the two-dimensional quantum Hall effect is encapsulated in this scaling flow diagram due to Dima Kamenetsky. He wrote it down immediately after Proyskin had identified the two components of the conductivity tensor as the coupling constants in the nonlinear sigma model that describes the non-interacting localization problem. But you can really think of it phenomenologically as well, and if there is a scaling description of the plateau transitions, then I think you're forced to view it more or less in this way. So the idea is that the flow along these green lines describes how the components of the conductivity tensor evolve as you look at the system at larger length scales experimentally by going to lower temperatures. And the stable fixed points with zero dissipation and quantized Hall conductance must be there if there's a quantum Hall effect at all. And presumably have to be some unstable fixed points separating them, and I think the simplest possibility is that there are single unstable fixed points between each of the stable fixed points. So if the scaling flow diagram looks like that, then there are a number of implications. First of all, if we scale to arbitrarily large distances, then there's only a discrete set of lines which end up at these unstable fixed points, and therefore the transitions between quantum Hall plateaus should be indefinitely sharp unless we have something to cut off the scaling flow. The scaling behavior in the vicinity of the unstable fixed points should characterize the quantum critical behavior at the plateau transitions. And the positions of these stable fixed points should be universal, and so we should be able to see universality in the values of the dissipative part of the conductance at the transitions between plateaus. And then finally, as I'll discuss in more detail later on, this scaling flow diagram implies that extended states levitate in energy as we turn off the magnetic field. So I want to talk about the experimental evidence and evidence from simulations in connection with each of these headings. And first of all, to talk about quantum critical behaviour, as we approach the transition, we expect that there should be a length scale which will diverge in some power law way, characterized by an exponent nu, and associated with that divergent length scale, there should be a divergent correlation time, which will be related to the length scale by a dynamic exponent z, and energies which would be the inverse of these correlation times will therefore vary with distance from the critical point as a power nu times z. And so, for instance, conductance will be given by scaling functions of this energy scale compared with whatever external cutoffs there are, for instance, temperature or a finite measurement frequency. And so by looking at the width of the transition as a function of temperature or frequency, we should be able to determine this exponent combination nu times z. If we want to determine the exponents nu and z separately, then we have to do something else. And one way is to look at how a finite current or finite electric field broadens the transition, and the idea is that there should be some electric field scale which we can convert to an energy by multiplying with this length scale and compare with the intrinsic energy as we approach the transition, and by making that comparison we find that the electric field scale will vary as a power of the distance from the transition, which is nu into z plus 1. So the first experiments in this direction are now 10 years old by H.P. Wei, who looked at how temperature broadens the plateau transition. So he looked at the width of transitions between plateaus, either in terms of rho xy or in terms of rho xx peaks or in terms of the derivative of rho xy with respect to field, and looked at how the transition sharpens up as you go to low temperatures. And the upshot is that whichever measure you take of the width of the transition, he found on a log-log plot straight line behavior with a gradient that corresponds to a value for this exponent product nu times z of about 2.3. And then more recently he looked at scaling with current, and again the story is that just as going to high temperatures broadens the transition, so going to high measuring currents broadens the transition, and again there's apparently power law behavior, and from this you can extract a value for the dynamical exponent of about 1. So those data, and also data on the scaling with frequency and the scaling with the size of the system in mesoscopic samples, seem to bear out the expectations that we have from the idea that these transitions are quantum critical points. Much more recently there's been measurements by Danny Shahar and collaborators which go completely in the opposite direction. I should say that Shahar's made a number of measurements on quantum Hall systems, and some of his results are compatible with the ideas of quantum critical behavior, in particular his results on duality between the insulator and the metal, although not forced by theories of quantum criticality. But these results, which I'm going to focus on, are most definitely incompatible. So the only thing which he does, which is apparently slightly different from the original measurements by Way, although it doesn't seem a difference that should be important, the only difference is to look not at the transition between two quantum Hall plateaus, but rather to look at the transition as you increase magnetic field from the last quantum Hall plateau to the insulator. So here's his data for rho xx plotted on a logarithmic scale as a function of filling factor. So at highest magnetic fields, that's to say low filling factor, the system's in the insulator, and the resistance increases as you go to lower temperatures. And at lower magnetic fields, that's to say higher filling factor, the system's in a quantum Hall plateau, and the dissipation decreases as you go to lower temperatures. So one fact which in a sense is incidental for what I have to say but makes the analysis simpler is that the resistivity seems to vary as a function of filling factor in a rather simple way, as the exponential of something that's linear in the filling factor. And given that it does vary in that way, you can extract a measure essentially of the width of the transition from the quantum Hall plateau to the insulator by looking at the gradient of the variation with filling factor. And the bad news is that when you look at how the width of the transition varies as a function of temperature, firstly, it doesn't appear to vary in the Pavlov fashion that Way found, and much more seriously, it seems to have a finite intercept in the low temperature limit, which gives, of course, a finite transition width at zero temperature. Actually, the width of this transition is rather small. It's the value of this coefficient beta, and that varies in a range of samples from something like 5% of the Landau level width to something like a third of a percent of the width. But nevertheless, it's something which seems impossible to understand in the theoretical framework, and I think these experiments are one of the main open difficulties. No, I mean, I mean, as we go from as we sweep the Fermi energy through the Landau level, then this delta nu in this notation varies between minus a half and plus a half. So I mean, the scale that I should compare this beta with is 1. So I mean 5% in filling factor, or a third of a percent in filling factor. Between 0.03 and 0.05. It's a range from different samples rather than a minus sign. Well, the point that Shahar emphasizes is the behavior of rho xy rather than sigma xy, which appears to be constant and equal to 1 in the usual units right through the transition. Okay, so from an experimental point of view, that's a summary of the extent to which one sees quantum critical behavior. Let me now go on to the question of the universality of sigma xx at the transition. This is the analog for the quantum Hall effect of one of the pictures that we saw this morning from Kravchenko, If we look at the resistivity, again on a logarithmic scale, as a function of temperature, if we cool the system down in a quantum Hall plateau, then the resistance drops to very small values, and if we cool it down when we're in the insulator, then it goes to high values at low temperatures, and in between there's a separatrix, and from the value of the resistivity on that separatrix, you can look at whether rho xx at the transition is universal between different samples. And again, from Dan Tsui's group, there's data on a range of samples which seem to show universality at something like a 20% level, but not higher. And presumably, you have to attribute the variations between different samples and actually between different cooldowns to large-scale inhomogeneities in the system, but nevertheless it seems a pity that something which should be absolutely universal is only universal at that kind of level.
John, how much should you be bothered by the fact that exactly the same group, more or less in the same samples, have two papers, one in which there is no scaling and the other one, presumably there is universal quantum resistance, so presumably it's a quantum critical phenomenon.
Yeah, well, I mean, from a theoretical point of view, it would be very nice to have some reason to put the data which I showed on the last transparency that doesn't fit with critical ideas, to put that on one side, but...
So you're just forgetting about that one for the time being, is what you're saying?
Well, I mean, as a theorist, you'd like to, but I don't have a reason to. Okay, and then as a final implication of the scaling flow diagram, I'd like to talk about what's called levitation in energy of the extended state. So soon after the scaling flow diagram was first proposed, both Kamenetsky and Laughlin asked what happens to the integer quantum Hall effect as you turn off the magnetic field, and the point is that at zero magnetic field we expect that state should all be localized, and so somehow the extended states have to go away. And I think Laughlin's point was that we should think of the extended states, for instance here in the energy magnetic field plane, as being boundaries between distinct phases which are characterized by the value of the Hall conductance. And once you think of them as phase boundaries, then they can't simply end, and the only place for them to go is up in energy. And this means that if you take a given system at a certain disorder strength and vary the magnetic field, then it should be possible to go in a re-entrant way from the insulator into a Hall conductor and back into the insulator again. And indeed, that's something which Zhang has shown is possible. Here, this is looking at the dissipative part of the resistance, again on a logarithmic scale, and in the insulator at both low fields and high fields we have a resistance which increases as we go to low temperatures, whereas in the Hall conductor it decreases. It's perhaps worth saying that the really interesting aspect of levitation is maybe up here, but that's unfortunately probably almost untestable. At high energies we expect that the localization length should be exponentially large between the extended states, and then simply diverge as we come to the extended states, and that's presumably something which is very, very difficult to test. Things in a lattice model are a bit more complicated, because in a lattice with a magnetic field, the band splits into a number of subbands, some of which carry positive Hall conductance and some carry negative Hall conductance. And what one expects as disorder is turned up is that these bands merge, and the idea of the scaling flow diagram is that they should merge in such a way that we have transitions at which the Hall conductance changes only by one unit, which is something which has been questioned on the basis of numerics, although I think it's actually a rather hard problem numerically. So although some experiments do support the idea that we have transitions, for instance, from the insulator to the state with a Hall conductance of 1, there are other experiments which seem to suggest something different is going on. And these again are from Dan Sui's group, this time on a gated silicon germanium p-type sample. And their point is that if they look at a certain electron density examine how the components of the resistivity are changing when they change temperature, then typically there's a crossing point of the curves. That's to say, in this diagram at low fields, the resistance increases as you go to lower temperatures, and at high fields, it decreases. And on the basis of those sorts of measurements, they suggest a phase diagram which looks something like this in the plane of magnetic field and gate voltage. So as you increase the gate voltage, you can go from a low density sample at high gate voltages to a high density sample at low gate voltages. And if the phase diagram really is like this, that's to say with direct transitions from a state, for instance, with Hall conductance of 3 to an insulating state, that's definitely in contradiction to the ideas of the scaling flow diagram. Actually, I'm much less concerned about these experiments than Shahar's, because it seems to me that the change in the resistance when you span the range of temperatures which are investigated is actually rather small, and I'd like to emphasize that it's much smaller than, for instance, in Zhang's measurements, where resistance is plotted on a logarithmic scale. By contrast, in this data, the resistance scale is linear. Clearly, there's something for theoreticians to understand here, but it doesn't seem to me that one's forced to accept that as you go to lower and lower temperatures, you'll necessarily wind up with this phase diagram. So that's a summary of the experimental situation. Let me now go on to talk about simulations. Most simulations are concerned with models of non-interacting systems. And actually, I'm going to say nothing about interactions at all, except to point out that Zeke Wang Wang will cover the topic in the next talk. In these simulations, you can ask whether the critical behavior that's seen is, as it should be, independent of the details of the model. And of course, you can check for independence of the numerical method that's used. So the variations that you can make in the model that you use involve different choices of the way to discretize the system. So, for example, you can study electrons moving in the lowest Landau level, projecting the Hamiltonian, and using various kinds of random potential. You can look at the network model, or you can study electrons on a tight binding lattice with a magnetic field introduced via Pyle's phases. In terms of numerical methods, you can either study samples in a quasi one-dimensional geometry using transfer matrix calculations, or you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian for a system that's, say, square, and calculate the Hall conductance and identify extended states by looking at the Chern numbers of states. And essentially, I believe that the results from different models and using different methods agree so long as the models at their critical point have short distance properties which place them reasonably close to the unstable fixed point in the scaling flow diagram. But if you choose to study models which have a conductance which is much larger than the conductance value at the unstable fixed point, then the flow towards that fixed point is so slow that it's easy to observe apparent deviations from universality. Okay, so to summarize what comes out from those calculations, essentially you can measure numerically the scaling function which describes flow from the unstable fixed point to the stable fixed point that characterizes the quantum Hall plateaus in calculations on quasi-one-dimensional samples. The way that works is that you measure the localization length as a function of the width of the quasi-one-dimensional strip, and that follows a one-parameter scaling dependence on the localization length in the limit of large widths and its ratio to the width of the system. And you can test the independence of that scaling function on the choice of the model, and also in the process you get the way in which the localization length diverges as you approach the middle of the band, and in particular you find an exponent which is consistent with what you can extract from the experiments, which I described the experiments by way, although of course it's an open question why non-interacting systems should show behavior that's apparently in the same universality class as this exponent, as far as this exponent is concerned, as the experiments on interacting systems. Okay, so apart from looking at the scaling away from the unstable fixed point, you can also sit precisely at the critical energy and ask whether you can see scaling in the stable directions towards the fixed point by changing the microscopics of the model so as to place yourself either below or above the fixed point in terms of the short distance value of the conductance. And I think you can see as you I should say that in these calculations looking at finite size scaling on long strips, the ratio of the localization length on a strip of finite width to the strip width plays more or less the same role as the conductance in a bulk system. And so looking at the value of this ratio as a function of the width of the system, you essentially track out the flow towards this fixed point. And if you vary the microscopic details of the model so as to vary the short distance cutoff, the short distance value of the conductance, the short distance value of this amplitude ratio, then you can look in larger systems at how the ratio approaches a limiting value. And I think you can find evidence for scaling towards a fixed point, and you can also extract a value for the leading irrelevant exponent, and you can look for universality in the fixed point value of this ratio, which corresponds to universality in the value of sigma xx at the fixed point. And it's actually in this ratio that you see the best evidence for universality in the position of the fixed point, and I think a range of calculations agree on its value to within about 2%. Then finally, there are calculations looking at the universality of the fixed point conductance rather more directly by diagonalizing the Hamiltonian and using Kubo formula to calculate the conductance, and deliberately making different choices of the disorder to see whether different choices change the fixed point value of the conductance. And in this way, Ravin Bhat found universality within errors of about 10%, and in particular he showed that even if you make a rather asymmetric choice of the distribution of disorder, so that the density of states doesn't have any symmetry in energy between the low energy tail and the high energy tail of the Landau level, even if you make that choice, then the transition happens at a value of sigma xy that's close to 1/2. Okay, so to summarize what I have to say about the localization transition in two-dimensional systems, I think the most serious problems at the moment are with the experiments of Shahar. I think in terms of numerics on non-interacting systems, in the calculations which apparently don't fit with scaling ideas, one can at least attribute it to the system starting out too far from the fixed point for it to have time to flow to the fixed point in the range of system sizes that's available. So what I want to do next is turn to the quantum Hall effect in three-dimensional systems, but maybe it's worth stopping in case there are any questions at that stage.
In Shahar's experiment, even if you forget the offset, which is the problem,
yes.
Suppose the offset is zero, which I don't think it is, but suppose it is, even then, if the values of mu z are totally different from...
That's right, different by a factor of two.
Right. Yeah. Mu is more like one, because he's just measuring...
The question is one that a theorist reviewing someone else's experiments obviously can't answer. It's a question of whether there's some trivial problem with the experiment.
I mean, I can try to answer. I spent 2 days in Shahar and I was convinced that it's a trivial mistake. He convinced me there is no mistake. Those data need to be taken seriously.
Okay. 2 days to be convinced?
It took almost 2 whole days to be convinced. No, because he had thought about every question I had. So I'm convinced, and I was convinced he made a mistake before that.
Okay. So the comment is that
you don't need to have scaling or to involve the notion that you cross the concentration explain.
Okay, so the comment is that it's a symmetry property, that the system doesn't have to be at a quantum critical point, and it's specific to quantum Hall transitions. I didn't say more about it because, firstly, I don't have anything to add, and secondly, it didn't seem to me a problem. It's just an extra layer that one would like to understand.
Okay.
But what about being online? That's what I'm worried about. So the more exotic possibility in three dimensions is that we have something analogous to the two-dimensional situation with a sequence of bands of localized and extended states, with the localized states presumably where the overall density of states is lowest. And obviously the most interesting possibility is the second one, and so somehow the question is how to favour the second over the first, and the answer is reasonably obvious. It's that one should go to a layered system made up of layers, each of which in isolation would show the integer quantum Hall effect. And then we can hope that if we turn on some interlayer coupling, if it's not too strong, some features of the quantum Hall effect will remain even in this three-dimensional system. So we can guess that the phase diagram is a function of the strength of the coupling between planes, and the Fermi energy might look something like this. In a single layer, as we sweep the Fermi energy up through the Landau levels, we go from the insulator through a sequence of delocalization points into successive quantum Hall plateaus. And if we then couple together a number of layers, if we're in the middle of the one of the quantum Hall plateaus, then we expect states to be strongly localized and presumably will remain localized even in the presence of some interlayer coupling that's not too strong. Whereas if we're close to one of these delocalization points where the states within each layer have a very large localization, then it's presumably rather easy to delocalize them and get into a metallic phase even with quite weak interlayer coupling. So we can imagine a phase diagram which would look like this, and then depending on the strength of the interlayer coupling, if we cut through it at some energy, we'll either get a sequence of quantum Hall plateaus if the coupling is weak, or we'll go directly from the insulator to the metal if the coupling is strong, which corresponds to the two possibilities which I talked about here. So that's pure conjecture, and you can offer various supporting arguments. One is to think what would happen in a system with a finite number of layers, and then because a system with a finite number of layers is ultimately two-dimensional, we can presumably use the scaling flow diagram. And at short distances, as we sweep through a Landau level of an n-layer system, we should increase the Hall conductance by n units, and that means we'll intersect n trajectories which are leading to these unstable delocalization fixed points. And therefore, as a function of energy across the Landau level of the n-layer system, we'll see the localization length diverge n times, so that in a single layer we'd have the usual divergence. In a two-layer system, the localization length would diverge twice, and in an n-layer system we'd have n divergences, and between each divergence the minimum value of the localization length would be large, and in the limit as n goes to infinity you can imagine this going over into a metallic band. You can also try to get at the problem by asking about the width of the metallic band at weak interlayer coupling. In other words, what the shape of the phase boundary is down here. And then if we imagine two layers with localized states within each of the layers before we turn on the interlayer coupling, the question is, how strong does the interlayer coupling have to be to mix these two states together and make one state which would ultimately be extended when we add more layers? And a naive guess at the answer is to say that the strength of the tunneling matrix element between these two states has to be comparable with their spacing in energy. And the spacing in energy should just be the inverse of the density of states per unit energy per unit area within one of the planes multiplied by the area that one of these states occupies. And the matrix element of the coupling between the two states will be given by some overlap integral. And then because these wave functions are normalized, if I just took the modulus of the integrand, this integral would be 1. But without the modulus sign, the integrand will have a fluctuating sign, fluctuating phase rather, and the number of independent contributions will be the area occupied by the state divided by the square of the phase coherence length, the mean free path, so the value of the integral will be of order 1 over the square root of that number, that's to say 1 over the two-dimensional localization length. So from that argument you find that the critical coupling that's required to delocalize the states within each layer should vary like the inverse of the 2D localization length, that's to say like the energy separation from the critical point in an isolated layer to this two-dimensional exponent, that's to say roughly quadratically. Okay, so you have the idea that in a layered three-dimensional system it should be possible to have a three-dimensional quantum Hall effect, and perhaps the most interesting aspect of that three-dimensional quantum Hall effect is what happens at the surface when the system is in one of the bulk quantum Hall plateaus. And the answer is that you get, in isolated layers you'd have edge states running around the edge of each layer, and when you couple the edge states in each layer together you produce on the surface of the sample a two-dimensional conductor. You can forget about the bulk because the states within the bulk should be strongly localized, but it's a two-dimensional conductor which is different from others because of the chiral motion of the particles around the surface of the system. And one of the important consequences of this chirality is that there's a suppression of interference effects. For example, in a non-chiral system, in an ordinary two-dimensional system, in the presence of some time reversal symmetry breaking like a magnetic field, you'd have quantum interference between particles which had followed a figure of eight trajectory in one direction and particles which have followed it traversing the two loops in the opposite order. Given the chiral motion of the electrons around this surface, the only way that you can generate interference terms of this kind is if you consider particles which traverse several times around the surface of the sample. So if the inelastic scattering length is shorter than the circumference of the sample, or alternatively if particles have time to diffuse to contacts at the either end of the sample before they circumnavigate it, then quantum interference effects are essentially suppressed. And because of that it turns out to be very simple to work out at least some properties of the chiral metal essentially exactly. There are two ways that you can approach the problem. One in terms of a directed network model in which you consider the propagation of electrons phase coherently at a given energy, and you imagine contributions to the amplitude to propagate from some initial point to some final point by various possible chiral paths, and each of these paths has a weight which involves phase factors according to the path that it's followed and amplitudes according to whether it tunnels between layers or stays within a layer. And then, for instance, to calculate the conductance, you can go via the Landau formula, which would give you the conductance as E squared on H times the sum of probabilities to get from different points along one end of the cylinder to different final points along the top edge of the cylinder. And these probabilities can be written in terms of Feynman path amplitudes. And if the phase that an electron picks up from each section of the edge of each layer is randomly distributed, then when you think about working out the average conductance and averaging products of these amplitudes, the only terms which survive the diagonal terms, which correspond to a directed classical random walk. And so because of that, you can work out, for example, the average conductance exactly. Okay, thanks. Alternatively, you can go to a Hamiltonian description, and the Hamiltonian for the system involves a term linear in the momentum in the chiral direction, and a term which describes hopping between different edges and some randomness from the disorder around the edge, so that just from the kinetic energy we'd have a kind of one-sided Fermi surface in the space of momentum around the edge and perpendicular to the edges. And then when you work out Green's functions for this Hamiltonian, it turns out that the simplicity comes about because essentially the Born approximation, together with ladders to calculate diffusion propagators, is an exact treatment of the problem, in the sense that higher order terms are small in the ratio of the correlation length of the disorder to the mean free path. Essentially the point is that because of the chiral motion, electrons never have a chance to revisit the same impurity several times. So it's possible to study conduction in this chiral metal in the regime in which quantum interference effects can be neglected because of the chiral motion. It's possible to study conduction essentially exactly, and skipping some of the details, you find a conductivity that varies with the mean free path for scattering and the strength of the coupling between layers and the velocity of the electrons in their chiral motion. In terms of comparison with experiments, one difficulty about this result is that it involves two things that one doesn't know very well in advance. One is the mean free path, and the other is the velocity for the chiral motion. And so for that reason, it's interesting to try and think of ways to get a handle on these different quantities separately. And one which I've been looking at recently with Shivaji Sundi is to think about the transverse magnetoresistance. So by this I mean that we think of the chiral two-dimensional system with the magnetic field that's producing the bulk quantum Hall effect perpendicular to the layers, and ask what the effect would be of tilting the sample in this magnetic field, that's to say adding a second component to the magnetic field which penetrates between the layers. And we find that essentially Drude theory gives the exact answer for the behavior of the magnetoconductance. A large perpendicular magnetic fields, the conductance gets suppressed, and the field scale for the suppression of the conductance is that field which puts one flux quantum through an area of size, the spacing between the layers multiplied by the mean free path. So hopefully magnetoresistance measurements will give a way of determining separately the mean free path and the velocity of this chiral motion. Then finally and briefly, let me talk about what happens if you go into regimes in which the quantum interference effects, which I've been neglecting so far, become important because the inelastic scattering length is long enough that electrons have time to orbit phase coherently many times around the cylinder. In that regime, it turns out that you can have three kinds of behavior according to the geometry of the sample. So what we should do to identify the regimes is compare, for instance, the length of the sample with two other length scales which are important. One is a diffusion length, which is the distance that electrons can diffuse in the direction perpendicular to the layers in the time that it takes them to orbit once around the circumference of the sample. And the behavior which I've been talking about so far is what you expect in the regime in which the sample is too short for electrons to orbit the circumference fully before they leave by either the top or the bottom edge. If you consider samples which are longer than that, then you get into a regime in which the sample is essentially quasi one-dimensional, but still metallic in the sense that its conductance between the bottom end and the top end is large compared with the quantum unit of conductance. If you go to longer samples still, then there comes a length scale which will be the quasi one-dimensional localization length at which the conductance of the sample drops to a value of E squared on H, and then for samples longer than that you expect to have a quasi one-dimensional insulator. So to summarize, what you expect for the quantum Hall effect in three dimensions is something like this. In terms of a phase diagram, as a strength of the coupling between layers in a layered sample, we expect, as we vary the Fermi energy, to be able to go from an insulator through a metallic phase into a quantized Hall conductor and then into another metallic phase and so on. In terms of the different components of the conductivity tensor or the conductance in different directions, as we vary the Fermi energy, the in-plane dissipative part of the conductivity should be non-zero, of course, when we're in the metallic phase, and zero in the insulator and the quantum Hall conductor. And as we sweep through the metallic phase, the Hall conductance should increase from one plateau value to another. As far as this behavior is concerned, the main difference from the quantum Hall effect in two-dimensional systems is that this transition region, the metallic phase, has a finite width in energy or in filling factor. If we look at the conduction perpendicular to the layers, then we find two kinds of behavior according to whether we're in the metal, in which case the conductance should be proportional to the cross-sectional area of the sample, or if we're in the quantum Hall plateau, then the conduction should take place just through surface states, and we should find a conductance which is proportional to the perimeter rather than the cross-sectional area of the sample. Okay, thank you.
Geometry in sigma xx. However, values were not 0.5 of E squared over H, but approximately 0.3. And we found weak approximately logarithmic temperature dependence, whose values only decrease slightly with decreasing temperature.
So I guess the question is about an observation of a non-universality in sigma xx values.
Well, it's as universal as anybody ever observed, so I'm just thinking this as the most universal observation of peak values of sigma xx, that indeed there is equal peak values in a given sample. But there is weak logarithmic decrease, which might be conjectured as similar to like some interaction of that. I don't know if you are familiar with this or not.
Yeah.
So would you say this is in contradiction with Bigson? I mean, their experiment is not in Corbino.
Well, we have the sigma sets, we don't extract.
Yeah, I understand. But is that your contention? It is in contradiction or no? I'm trying to make you comment.
This is between quantum Hall plateaus. This is not the quantum Hall to insulator transition.
Okay.
Quantum
so
Hall to insulator.
Maybe we
okay.
I didn't quite understand the definition of little L in this last series. It's the mean free path in zero field. Or what is the definition of that?
It's the mean free path in strong field for these edge states.
If there's no scattering, if I had say U equals 1 and there was no interlayer coupling, there'd be no mean free path, right? There's nothing to scatter
to. Okay, so this was something which I meant to say but ran out of time to explain. If you think of a single edge, then you describe the edge state by a Hamiltonian like this. And if you write down, for instance, the wave function at zero energy, then it'll just be a phase factor, and that phase will... sorry, there's a mistake here. That phase is basically the integral with respect to the coordinate x of the potential. So the mean free path is the distance that a particle has to go along one particular edge to pick up a phase of order 1 from... Yes, yeah. So particles on... If you had a single edge, that phase would be irrelevant, but if you have particles tunneling between different edges, then it matters if they pick up different phase shifts on different edges.
I just wanted to understand what was the definition of L was.
Yeah, okay.
Can you put back Shahar's thing again? I'm sorry to go back to that one, but I think it's sufficiently important for people to the origin of one. I just want to show a transparency which comes.
Right.
I want to show a transparency comes from the nature of her actually. Gave them to you last month. So these are the data that John was just showing over here, not exactly the same but similar data, rho xx as a function of mu, and the formula he showed you,
alpha and beta value.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let me, yeah. Alpha and beta values. So it's exactly the same, sorry about that. Exactly the same formula that he had with certain values of alpha and certain value of beta. Okay. And you can see the data like that. What the dangerous thing that he showed me is that this data actually scaled beautifully. This scaling is as good as any scaling we have seen today, okay? And I mean, I was astounded seeing that. And in fact, what he told me, he went back to Wei's data, and he found Wei's data completely consistent with that formula. He's claiming the scaling Wei is seeing is just because, as we all know, anybody who has done critical phenomena, if you keep your parameter range small enough, you can always see scaling. And this is... If he did not directly fit his data, if he did scaling, he would have completely scaled beautifully. You can see how good this scaling is. And he claims that in flaw after flaw, he gets beautiful scaling. This is some other data. This is just a mathematical formula, not even data, he tells me. Again, scaling is very good. But as you can see in the formula, that coefficient beta is finite, which means there is no scaling. Again, of course, you cannot do it for temperature range over three orders of magnitude, but experiments don't extend over three orders of magnitude, extends over one order of magnitude. So just concentrating on scaling and seeing very good scaling doesn't mean... And he told me that he went back to Wei's data and found even that is consistent with his formula, meaning this, you know, beta being finite. And that's when I kind of gave up.
Beta is the
author. Beta
is the author.
Right.
With that, why don't we move on to the next session and thank our speaker once again.
Thank you.